October 1st, 2015. My name is Jeannie Phillips. I've worked for the university since 1981 and had the distinct pleasure of working with Mark Hamilton for that entire time that he was a president at the University of Alaska. Leslie McCartney, our oral archivist, is here today too, videotaping this session. And we are just thrilled that you would take the time to do this. You are a very important part of the University of Alaska history, and we felt it was really important to get you on film and just telling us about yourself and then, of course, about your tenure here at the university.
Wonderful.
So welcome. So first, if we could just start off with what you usually start off with is, where do you come from?
Where do I come from? Well, I was born in 1945 and in Hackensack, New Jersey, and spent a little time there, went through third grade there, second grade, and then went to Florida, St. Petersburg, Florida, and grew up there all through high school. Wonderful, wonderful place to be, great place for a kid, and just had a great time there. I still have a fishing buddy every year who comes up, who was my best friend in third grade. Mm. So there's a great continuity there. It's important. I was quite an accomplished football player, and I was recruited by many, many schools. Signed with Bear Bryant at Alabama. Mm. Always very proud of that. But then along came West Point, and different era. In those days, Pete Dawkins was the first captain. He was on the cover of Time magazine like 2 years prior. So the opportunity to go to West Point was simply impossible to turn down, and I did.
Did your family have a history of being in the military?
My dad
service?
Was in the Naval Reserve and okay. actually retired from it. He spent about 5 years in the Navy during World War II.
Okay.
And then he stuck with it in the Naval Reserve thing. So he had to change his loyalties on the Army-Navy.
Yes,
game.
He did.
Pretty quickly. And that was, West Point was just a beautiful, formative period in my life, for several reasons. One of which was, they actually take the time to try to prepare you to be a leader. And they do that with opportunities to lead. Be a squad leader, and a platoon leader, and then a company commander, and that sort of thing. And preach the values of the military, which are transcendent. I mean, take care of the people who mm-hmm. work for you, respect them, support them, back them, seek their advice. That was the kind of the message, you know. I've often told people that there can't possibly be a profession, unless it's lawyers, that is more badly treated in jokes and comedy skits and everything than the Army. The Army is nothing like that. Leadership is nothing like that. You only have one George Patton, okay? The rest, I think, aspire to be Marshall.
You know, exactly.
You know, just a different way of looking at things. Another thing it did, though, that really greatly affected my life was that it made it absolutely clear there's no such thing as a born leader.
Mm-hmm.
This is something you have to pursue. You have to study. You have to practice. You have to analyze and be self-critical and seek those kinds of inputs
yes.
from others to kind of hone those skills. And I enjoyed that. I could feel more and more comfort about being a leader.
One thing I remember you telling me at West Point is that I don't think a lot of people understand was the wonderful liberal arts education you got there. And I don't think that's, sometimes people don't have an understanding. That's how you got into poetry, I understand, was from your training at West Point.
Well, I had actually written poetry, although you really have to stretch the genre to encompass what I wrote. But was always very, very interested in it. And it was certainly something that could be done and was done while mm-hmm. I was at West Point. When I later in my life, after Vietnam, I came back and was advised by West Point that they'd like to have me come back and teach. And I say this as a joke, but it's not entirely incorrect. The Spanish department wanted me to come back, and they said, okay, you spend a year at Pennsylvania and then a year in Madrid. Mm-hmm. That sounded really good. And then the English department said, want you to come back, and you can go anywhere. I mean, the education at West Point was so ridiculous. I mean, my GRE scores were like 1460 or something. I mean, you could go anywhere you wanted,
yes,
pretty much. And then the physical education department wanted me back, and they said, we'll give you 2 weeks to get in shape. But no, actually, they sent those people to Duke, and they had a wonderful time there. But I chose English, and I was actually very, very badly prepared for it because I had, in essence, sort of freshman English and just the most peripheral scan of authors and poets and this sort of thing. Not something that an English major would mm-hmm. have had. So it was quite a difficult time. Instead of taking the graduate class from a professor I'd had in undergraduate, I was taking a graduate class with a professor I'd never seen on a subject I'd never seen.
Oh.
I mean, Victorian literature, sure, why not? What is that? I mean, I didn't even know what that was. So the good news was just this massive canon of work that people had taken snippets of. I mean, I was just grabbing the whole thing and just mm-hmm. reading everything I could, all the criticism on the back. So that kind of composite thing actually allowed me to fare very well. But I want to tell you a poetry story. So I wanted to get into to just play around with poetry because I always enjoyed it. And as a graduate student, you wanted to go into poetry 401 or something like that.
Is this at West Point?
No, this is now at Florida State.
At Florida State, okay.
Okay. So, what you had to do is, in essence, a recital, or, you know, so here. So I turned in this group of poems, and as a direct quote, the professor said, this is crap. It's exactly what he said. This is crap. You know, because I kind of had that thing about, okay, this is all about sunshine and sunsets and love and all this. He says, write about something you know.
Yes.
And you can't come into my graduate class at all, but I'll let you come into my undergraduate class. And the first assignment is to write a poem about something you actually know and turn it in. So I come into the first day of class, and the projectors, you know, the
oh yes,
the projectors,
the old
up on
overhead
the wall.
Projector, yes.
And there's my poem.
Oh,
on the wall. I mean, on the, whatever it was, the board. And he told the class, I actually don't expect you to write a poem that is this solid by the time you're done. However, if you knew what this person turned into me only 2 weeks ago, I can teach anybody.
So he took the kudos for that, right?
Yeah, he did. He said, I can teach anybody. And the teaching there, as often happens in our lives, was a single confrontation with reality by somebody who knew, and obviously from the second part of the story, cared.
Yes.
You know? And it changes you dramatically when you have that kind of an experience. I went back to West Point, and a classmate of mine, great friend, Denny Coates, and I wrote a book of poetry called To the Colors. And what we did was really very enjoyable and I think unique. We wanted to try all the types of poetry. Okay? Everything from a sestina to heroic couplets, sonnets, haiku, whatever it was. And we would try to pick images of West Point that were important. And then Denny would begin a poem, and I would begin a poem. And then we would just trade them and say, okay, fix that. And the fix could be dramatic. It could be, you didn't really get the sestina right. Let's try this one here in a sonnet, okay, or something like that. And at the end of it, by the time we had publishable material, the overwhelming majority of those poems, I could not tell you that was mine that Denny worked on or that was Denny's that I worked on. There's a couple.
True collaboration.
It really was. And we felt, hey, you're young and you're thinking, God, this is wonderful and this is what the art ought to be and all that kind of stuff. But so, I have continued to write poetry and likely will. I mean, most of my life tend to be occasional poems now. It so happens that today we're going to go celebrate the life of Darlene Myers as a wonderful, wonderful confidential secretary for part of my tenure here. And I've written her a poem.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And I think you'll like it.
I know I will. One of my very, very fond memories of your time in the president's office was you rehearsing poetry on us.
Yeah.
And darned if you didn't make me cry almost every single time. So that is a very special memory to those of us that got to be your rehearsal partners.
It's the rehearsal part. That really, tell you another kind of leadership lesson. I was in the eighth grade, and I went to school, and then I fished and played. I mean, it was a different world back then, and an eighth grader. I mean, you weren't dating, for crying out loud. You weren't, you were still a kid.
You were a kid.
Very much a kid. And with beautifully aimless, just enjoying. Went fishing all the time, and I loved it. Well, the principal, whose name was Kenneth Price, and he came to one town, he says, Hamilton, okay, next year, I want you to try out for the basketball team, and, this year, try out for the basketball team, and enter the speech contest. And so I did. Made the first layup I ever tried, and made the basketball team, which gives you a pretty good indication of how terribly bad the basketball team was. But, in any case, I entered the speech contest. Well, in that particular year, I didn't even make it out of the junior high school. I mean, I wasn't the one sent forward. And so that was kind of, okay, Mr. Bryce, I did. He said, do it again.
Oh.
And So the next year, I went to the state finals.
Wow.
And I didn't win. I didn't even place. But there were, you know, like seven or eight of us that were there at the thing. And you're in the ninth grade, and you've got 200 business people sitting out there. And you got them absolutely captured. And you've rehearsed this, and you know, and you can see them, and you can emphasize when it needs to be emphasized. So it got all the way done. No prizes, but what a lesson.
Yes.
That said, public speaking counts.
It does.
And the thing that you reminded me of that on the rehearsal, can't tell you how many times I've had very wonderful, well-meaning people just say, oh, God, it's so wonderful. You have this gift of public speaking. And, you know, you thank them because it's kindness and everything else. In the back of my mind, do you have any idea how long I rehearsed that?
not off the top of
no,
the head.
No, it's not off the top of your head. It ought to be off the top of your heart.
And it always was.
Yes. Yeah.
It always was. I'm going to reel you back to West Point.
Sure, let's go back.
You played football.
I did indeed, yes.
What position?
I was a halfback, another true story, kind of a foible here, I suppose. I was a halfback in my sophomore year. I did quite well, actually. Played more minutes than anybody but the starting quarterback, which is a really good start.
Yes.
In my junior year, they actually took a guard and made him the tailback because he was faster than I was.
Oh.
So I really felt terrible. He was a much better ball player all the way around. So they turned me into a fullback, which in our offense was a tackle with the number 40 on it. I mean, just lineman's helmet, lineman's gear all the way down, high-top shoes, you know, I mean, just a blocker. So I loved it. I actually loved that particular thing. And then my senior year, and again, I tell this story on myself, but it's absolutely true. The best thing I ever did for Army football was in a Penn State game, starting off with a great season. I think I had 100 yards the first two games, but halfway through the third game, I actually got a hairline fracture in my leg. And so the second team guy got to play. He was so much better than I was that it wasn't funny. I mean, he was an athlete. His name was Charlie Jarvis. Charlie Jarvis went on to break all of the records of like Glenn Davis. I mean, he was a magnificent. I'm sure he was All-American, at least honorable mention or something like that. So I tell people, and I mean, in all sincerity, the best thing I did for Army football was break my leg and let Charlie get in there. That's true. It's absolutely true. He was wonderful, and even then, it's another kind of a lesson. I mean, it was a better team because Charlie was in. I wasted, which is fairly mature now that I look back at it. You know, I wasted no time at all. Like feeling sorry for myself or something like that.
Beautiful.
It was, teams got a magnificent back. Go Army. I mean, I really felt it. I didn't have to fake it. And that's nice. It's a kind of a confrontation with humility, which I can tell you, as a leader, that is a fairly constant companion, is humility. It's not that you get things wrong. It's just that they don't turn out the way you had intended, kind of a thing. You know, and you kind of go, I'll have to fix that one next time. You know, that kind of thing.
Well, Patty must have come along about this time.
Patty came along with Mr. Price. She showed up the eighth grade year.
Oh.
Junior high school, Medallon Junior High School. And I had a buddy of mine named Rick Viet, and we were buddies. And again, you got to go back to the times. This is eighth grade. I mean, I've never been on a date. I didn't even know anybody who had ever been on a date. And I turned to Rick and I said, "Who is that new girl?" And he said, "Well, her name's Patty Behrens. She just came down from New York." And I said, "I believe I'll marry that one."
Really?
Yeah,
at eighth grade, you said
eighth
this.
Eighth grade. Believe I'll marry that one. In the ninth grade, we had a date. My mom took us to the little thing and picked us up afterward. And that was it for me.
That's wonderful.
That was it. I mean, just...
What year did you get married then?
Well, we got married right after I graduated. You couldn't get married at West Point.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So...
How many hours after you graduated?
Well, it was 3 days. It was 3 days afterwards we got married, along with virtually all of our friends. What a great... And the football was a central part of West Point, but what a fabulous thing to realize we still, of course, meet and love these people, because all of the girls for our, you know, six or eight really close buddies, all of them were high school sweethearts.
Oh.
Okay? All of them moved up to... New York or a place called Highland Falls, which is right outside the gate, for our senior year, because you had a little more freedom there. You know? And so they all know each other. I mean, knew each other all the way back, and
yes.
So just a beautiful thing. And they're all still married to
really?
High school students. Yeah. We could have about a 6, 7, 8 couple 50-year anniversary here in 2 years.
That's impressive.
It really is. I mean,
that's
so
impressive.
Such a contrast to today.
Yes.
Really was a different world, and a beautiful one to grow up in, and to learn the skills of leadership. I suspect that they're more difficult today.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere between political correctness and
yes.
litigation, we have kind of excluded the kind of bravado that was part of leadership then. To go out and take a chance,
yeah.
You know? I'm going to go this way and see what happens.
Yeah.
And freedom to fail
yes.
was real. Because without all the checks and balances and everything else to sort of guide it, instead of everybody trying to get through a chute like this, the chute was this wide.
Yes.
You could go and be yourself and try and, you know, over time they moved toward the middle because the fringes didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
But at least you get to try them.
You got to try.
You know, it was a wonderful place to. Wonderful time to
yes.
grow up in.
Well, you have had an incredible Army career, a military career. I mean, it really has been. Just kind of walk us through some of your postings. And you went from a second lieutenant, I would assume. Is that what you come
That's
out
what
of,
you're commissioned as, yeah.
Commissioned as, to all the way up to a two-star.
Major general, two-star general.
Yeah. So that is very impressive. So kind of walk us through how that progression happened in some of your postings.
Yeah, okay. Well, a fairly common career. Of course, virtually all of us, everybody in my company opted for their first assignment to be Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a war on.
What year?
This was 1967.
Okay.
So there's a war on, and you've been trained to do this. So
yes.
Everybody wants to go. And we did. Obviously lost some very, very close friends. There were only 585 of us who graduated. So when you lose, you know, 20 or 25 people, you know who they are.
Yes.
And you actually know who they are. And that's painful lesson early on, but also is a lesson that says, you know, why am I in this?
Yes.
I mean, what am I doing? And many, many, many of us stayed all through the enormous dislike and hatred of the American people, which
yes.
Which was a kind of a tough thing. You couldn't kind of understand it, you know. Don't they understand that, you know, the President of the United States says go? I swore to, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And but anyway, those who stayed built the greatest army that there has ever been.
Mm-hmm.
And I know these people, and
yes.
I respect them, and I love them for it. So, normal career, I was a Ford observer as my first assignment, and that's an artilleryman who goes with an infantry company and helps direct artillery fire in support of their tactical operations. It was a wonderful opportunity for me, because you're an officer, but you're not really in the chain of command.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that goes from the company commander to the platoon leaders down through the NCO ranks and the like, and you're just kind of this sort of staff person. Now you're an officer, so you have to take your duties, go check the perimeter and all this kind of stuff, and be prepared to execute your skill set when it becomes necessary. But what happens is the soldiers are a lot more open with you. They feel a lot more
okay.
comfort with you, because you're not in this chain of command sort of a thing. And it was a wonderful opportunity for me to see and to bond with these soldiers. Two key recognitions. One was they were me.
Mm-hmm.
Some were a little older, some were a little younger. Some had college degrees, some had GED, some had no high school graduation mm-hmm. in those days. And they knew stuff. They really knew stuff about their job. I mean, they knew what to do. That machine gun, they knew how to care for it, and they did. Knew how to dig foxholes, and people kind of snickered that it's not a hole in the ground. There's a whole engineering assessment of building a foxhole. And they knew how to take sea rations and mix and match and make recipes out of them and
make them edible.
Make them absolutely edible. And this would help Fairbanks today with their power,
yes,
power shortage, because one of the things that they showed me, if you take, they have little tins of peanut butter that they would have in there. If you take the tin of peanut butter and you put bug dope in it, okay, and stir it up, burns just like Sterno.
Okay.
So you can, anyway, the key takeaway for me on that was this really a tremendous respect for mm-hmm. the enlisted soldiers, and something that has just become a watchword of every piece of leadership opportunity I've ever had. Deal with the people who do it for a living. Okay? I mean,
yes.
You don't have to learn that machine gun, as long as you know that Specialist Phillips can make that thing sing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you go to Phillips and say, having some trouble with some machine gun maintenance. Would you give us a hand here? I mean, I'll give you a class. What do you want to do? We'll put it together, and Phillips will take care of the whole thing instead of trying to get up there and have the officers do it or something. Get the person who does it for a living.
Yes.
And I've carried that with me ever since. So I went on through, you know, normal stuff. you got to work very hard, and we worked very, very hard in those days. Came up to be a battalion commander, which is a joy. It's the most marvelous assignment you can ever have. Mm-hmm. You've trained for it for 17 or 18 years. You've done the jobs in the battalion, because it's kind of the centerpiece of the Army. And you know what you're doing. Mm. You know what you're doing. You're just so prepared. Never again are you prepared for your job. When you become a division artillery commander, which I was in Alaska, it was mm-hmm. my first taste of Alaska. Well, you're only about 4 years older than the battalion commanders.
Yes.
And you remember what a joy that was for you. And they know what they're doing.
Yes.
You know, so I think they would draw straws, and once a week somebody would ask me a question so I'd feel important. In fact, they could run their battalions with no help from Colonel Hamilton, who was just watching with admiration these great soldiers do the thing. Then I had a very strange thing happen, and this is unique. All there is to it. I was in Fort Greely, Alaska, and I was called by a guy by the name of Max Thurman, 4-star general and commander-in-chief in Southern Command, which mm-hmm. is Panama. And this is probably be so outdated for you, you might not understand the reference, but to me it sounded like a Bob Newhart comedy scene.
Okay, well, I'm old enough to get that.
You know him? Because he used to do those things on the phone. So he's, Mark, Max Thurman. Yes, sir. How you doing? Hey, Mark, I got a war on and I need you. I said, wow, I've been waiting, 23 years since Vietnam for this call. Where are we going? I want you to go to El Salvador. God, that's not an island, is it? He said, har, har, har. You know, we're going around. He said, can you speak Spanish? And I said, I can fake it. He said, I'll get back to you. So there I was. I went down to El Salvador, and my job was make peace in mm-hmm. El Salvador. 12-year civil war, 70,000 dead, a million refugees, all to the United States.
Yes.
And good, good immigrants. I mean, these are wonderful people. Work very, very hard. So I spent about 6 weeks prior to that with a retired Venezuelan general, and we would just speak Spanish constantly and do drills constantly, and because he was really quite a teacher. And we would just do that every single day until we couldn't stand to be near each other again, pretty much. So I got pretty decent at it, actually.
Yes.
And then, of course, I had to practice it for a little over 2 years down there. But that is a quite a unique story, and it's, I think, excluding thing like marrying Patty and adopting two wonderful children from Korea, that was it. That was mm-hmm. the best thing I ever did.
And it resulted in peace.
It actually did. Actually did. There aren't any books on this, Janie.
I mean, you don't hear about it.
And my job's, I'm assigned at the embassy. They must know something about it. They have no more idea than a chicken how to make peace. They just know the various ways they can threaten people.
Yeah.
I'm terribly disappointed.
Can you walk us through how you did achieve making peace?
Well, it's a great story. Actually, Jeannie's already heard this story. It has an unlikely hero in the story. and it wasn't me. So I went to this village by the name of Santa Marta, and Bill Walker, who was the ambassador, had to take a very courageous step in allowing me to come to this village. And had to be in civilian clothes. But I had talked to him. I said, this is a war. Okay, if we're going to solve this thing, because I skipped a step there. There were people in the village. It was the home of part of the Resistencia Nacional that had indicated they might be willing to talk about peace.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to the village. And, you know, fascinating. I mean, the village. First of all, this is supposed to be a great secret. The ambassador gets up there to talk. He's totally drowned out by the crowd. And the square, just a little Mexican. Totally, Coronel, Coronel. They wanted me to speak to him.
Okay. Oh, so, Colonel.
Yeah, Colonel. Okay. Coronel, Coronel. So much for the State Department secrets. But in any case, we talked for a while, and I talked to him about, you know, looking forward to opportunities ahead and this, that, and the other. Of course, they reported to us they'd heard of guerrillas, but they'd never actually seen one, you know. So we said, okay, we're staying. And we literally went to a stable, and we had cots available. They provided them, and we sat there and waited. Well, then we had about 200
guerrillas?
Of the guerrilla force came out of the bushes,
uh-huh.
And came in there, and actually had a little dancing and fiesta kind of a time. But I'm approached, and one of them said, the comandante wants to see it. So we go to out of the village, down this little trail, and we go into this underground bunker. It's about the size of this room, just about the size of this room. And only place in the world I've ever seen actual soldiers who wore cross bandoliers.
Really?
Do you know how stupid that is?
No.
Bandoliers across. First of all, you got to manipulate anything until they can be usable. Secondly, they form this perfect X and they explode.
Okay.
I mean, this is dumb.
But it looked cool?
Actually did.
Okay.
I mean, it was kind of like you're going into a set. And all the while that you're doing this, you're going, what's going on here?
Yes.
I have no idea how to do this. I don't know what's going to come next. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I'm going to react. You know, it was a very, very interesting event. So I was met by a guy by the name of Raul Hercules. Hercules was his nom de guerre. Wonderful guy. I got several pictures with him that I was just reviewing recently. And Raul greets me and he said, I have no, in Spanish of course, but I have no idea why you think you can just walk into my camp like that. Fleeting thought was, actually every American that they have had until this moment, they have killed.
Yeah.
Missed that one. So, but he then expressed a kind of a vulgar term that said, at least you have courage.
Okay.
We'll leave it at the courage. And we sat down, and the ambassador was there, and I was there, and a couple of others, and drank chicha, which is looks about like that. It's corn liquor. And had it in a big gallon of plastic milk jug. So drinking chicha. And the kind of neener part of the story is sitting at the end of the table, straight out of central casting, is a guy with a black eye patch and an AK-47 pointed at
me. Whoa.
And this man wanted desperately to shoot me. There's just no question about it. And I mean, I would turn to Raoul and say, you know, is this actually necessary? I mean, you know, this, I mean, I'm unarmed. I mean, I haven't got any, you know. Ah, it's nothing. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. All right. So the guy is smoking cigarettes, and I smoked. And he's clawing with his hand over here. Cigarettes are empty. Does not take his eye off of me at all. Throws him on the ground. I go, toss him his pack of cigarettes. We're going to have this little bonding thing right here. Takes his cigarettes, put one in his mouth. Somebody from behind him lights it. Never, ever.
Never looks. Okay?
And he picks up the cigarettes and goes, and throws them on the ground. I went, okay, it's going to take some time before we. Anyway, Raoul decided that the interview was good enough, and he went and met me a couple of times. It was like a bad B movie. I mean, here we are doing these kind of double blind drops, and then finally reduce it to I left my bodyguard at home, just went with his bodyguard, and then finally he's going to come over to my house.
Mm-hmm.
My house is in a compound there, just my house, but huge wall around it, barbed wire, 10-foot thing, two machine gun nests outside of it. You know, the country's at war.
And,
so I had my bodyguard take the two guys from the machine gun, put them in the garage, and keep them there because in is coming this guerrilla leader. Now, I had kept the Salvadoran government informed of everything I did. This was not any lone wolf stuff. It was just kind of, trust me on this. You know, you want peace, okay? Well, this guy's going to... I need this guy. Let's not raid my house.
Yeah. Okay.
So I told Patty, of course, who had come down then. I kind of lied to her after the first year. I told her the war was almost over. I was just lonely. And she came down with my two adopted children. And, she just acclimated very well. I mean, I can recall her rolling over and saying, honey, that machine gun's at least a block away, isn't it? At least a block away. And she'd just go back to sleep. You know?
Oh, man.
So I told her, because we had a little safe room, big, thick metal door, but you just go in there and close it up tight in case everything went brown. And I assumed she and the kids would be in the safe room. Patty greets us at the door, and there's a little kiss on each cheek there for Raoul, I mean, kind of present them, and brings them in and sits them down at the dining room table. So he's having dinner with my family. And, you know, I'm doing the best I can to translate, because I could kind of get by, but translation's a very different skill set. Then afterwards, they kind of toddled away, and Raoul and I went in and drank some scotch and talked about what we might be able to do. Finally, there's enough movement here that the State Department gets involved with it, with a couple of other countries who were interested in making peace in El Salvador, and it graduated. And so finally, they're talking at the United Nations. And, you know, this is great. It's going along great as far as I'm concerned. I got called down to the ambassador's office Saturday. We worked Saturday, so that wasn't unusual that he would call me. And he was there with the vice president of El Salvador. And they both looked like their dog had been shot. I mean, they just... And they said, well, the talks have broken down, and they're actually trying to negotiate when they will end the ceasefire. Mm. And we're back. Remember, bad B movie, okay? I hold that out there. I know how absurd this all sounds. Obviously, we didn't have cell phones in those days. So ring, ring, ring. Ambassador... He said, okay, that is the governmental negotiating team, and they want to know if you can come to the United Nations and help them fix this. Well, Mr. Ambassador, whatever you want, your call, be delighted. Ring, ring, ring. Okay, that's the guerrilla negotiating team, and they're wondering if you could come to the United Nations and fix this. What do I tell them? And I said, you tell them I will be there as soon as I possibly can. Oh, and tell them I can fix it. And Walker turned to me and he said, you know what? You probably can.
Yeah.
Took off, back home, called Patty, said, get all the American money we have. It was $54.
Oh.
Warmest thing I had was a trench coat. I mean, right now in El Salvador, I absolutely promise you it's 82 degrees.
Yeah. Okay. It always is 82.
It's always 82 degrees. Always. Or in San Salvador, certainly. Some of the other parts get a little hotter. And anyway, so I'm a trench coat on and a pair of loafers with no socks. Hey, I was State Department, embassy, you know, kind of turned a little native there. Off I go, arrive at what's the airport in New Jersey?
Newark.
I arrive in Newark at like 2 a.m. Or maybe a little earlier, whenever the last flight got in there. Get a cab. United Nations was going to cost like $110 or something with the tolls. And I said I got $54. Okay, but I mean, I'll give you my card. I mean, I'm a soldier in the army. I mean, the last run of the day, I'll take the 54. So I took the 54. Drops me off at the UN. Went immediately into negotiations. And I went first to the FMLN group. So this is 2, 3 a.m., something like that. And the leader of them was Shafiq Handal, who was actually the only real communist in the group. You know, we just branded people in those days. You know, they weren't communists. They were people who wanted land.
Yes, yes.
You know, I told my special forces people who worked for me all the time. I said, you realize if this was happening in America, we'd be the guerrillas?
Yes.
I mean, it's just real. Any case. So Shafiq Handal hands me their list of stuff. I'm going over this stuff. Okay, that seems reasonable. I think we can get that. I mean, might be a little bit of negotiation, but I think we get that. And I said, for God's sake, this is just a political slogan or something. And Shafiq reaches over with his pencil
and
crosses it out. And I felt like the entire United Nations building had just landed on my shoulder. I just said, holy crap, they're going to listen to me.
Yeah.
I mean, that changes the dynamics.
Yes.
When all of a sudden, oh my God, they're actually going to follow these things. It isn't a casual observation. Well, then you do this back and forth. We had Thomas Pickering was our ambassador to the United Nations, and of course, so he was in charge of this whole thing, and he kind of shuttled me back and forth in his own automobile, back and forth between these groups. And we did this for about 8.5 days.
Wow.
At which time, everybody is suffering from some form of the Stockholm syndrome, and you just want to get it over with. I mean, it really. Yeah. So it kind of came down to one single item. And the single item was, they had these things called BERIs, which, you know, Spanish speaks backwards. That's Battalion Infantry Reaction Immediate.
Okay.
So Immediate Reaction Infantry Battalion.
Got it.
So they called BERIs, because that's how their acronym spells out. And these were very large and very dangerous and very controversial units, all kinds of terrible things blamed on them, only some of which were probably accurate. But anyway, they wanted them taken down, obviously, as part of the thing. And the government said, okay, we want to take like the entire month of whatever, because there were six of these. So in this month, this one will go down. But, you know, we want it to go down over the 30-day period. And the guerrillas said it has to be done by 2 weeks, in other words. And so I actually had a decent suggestion at that time, and went whispered to Pickering. These men are soldiers, okay? Ask them if they've ever heard of Solomon, okay? And they're good Catholic kids. Of course they'd heard of Solomon. And I said, well, you tell them, as soldiers they know, that half a beery is about as viable as half a baby.
Yes.
You bring it down halfway, it's gone. It is no longer a military threat. And he told them, and Solomon, okay. And they said, okay.
Wow.
They can do it like the government's way. Take it because, you know. And I said, I'll make sure that at halfway, they're halfway. And so that was it. They signed the peace treaty. It's never been broken.
What year was that?
That was 1992.
Yeah.
The FMLN was called the Farabundo Martí Liberación Nacional. The FMLN formed a political party. They elected two consecutive mayors of San Salvador. And I think one term ago, I think it had a six-year term, they elected the president of the country.
Mm.
So
that government is still standing then?
Yeah. No, they're fine.
They did
absolutely beautifully. And by the way, I don't think I have told you this one. Columbia University has decided to take a look at that scene. I mean, just now. So
really?
In March, I've been invited to go to Columbia. They want to, what went right is what they want to do. What went right? So get to trip down memory lane kind of thing, which they say is very important. I mean,
yes.
You know, it's a little country. There's only 7 million people in it. But I really was central to
yes.
that thing, and I feel really good about it. Really good.
Yes. You had another really important posting that I'm aware of, and that was in Somalia.
Yeah. Okay, I need to finish one thing
on El Salvador. Okay.
Yeah, see, because I was going to end it with I was the hero. You see? But that's not what happened. Raul came after the peace. Raul came to our house with his daughter.
Oh.
Raul had been married 2 times, both of his wives killed. Okay. Raul had been wounded 5 times, once by the government, 4 times by internecine battles with the various pieces, 5 pieces of the FMLN. And he was a teacher before the war. He'd been in the woods for 14 years. And he came in and he said, for 14 years, I felt like an animal. When your wife sat me down at your table with your family, I said, I'm going to make peace with this man.
Oh.
So, life lesson there, one act of kindness, of respect, trumped a year and a half of my attempts to negotiate and everything else. Just
Patty gets the
medal. Patty is actually the hero, yes.
Absolutely.
I've never been shy about telling that story. It's a wonderful story. And it
absolutely
happened just like that. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, but I did go to Somalia.
And this is after?
This is afterwards. And matter of fact, that's how I kind of got back to Alaska.
That's what I thought.
Okay, what happened was the chief of staff of the Army, Gordon Sullivan, who was just a wonderful, he just really believed in me. Okay, and He gave me the Distinguished Service Medal as a colonel, which was,
mm-hmm.
and he did it here in Alaska. But he had assumed I would make general. Well, what happens is the selection boards are looking for people who look like them. And they're going, well, Hamilton was doing pretty good. He got up here in brigade command. He's doing really great. What in the world is this next assignment? I mean, this is an assignment for a colonel, none of whom ever get promoted. I mean, it's not, so the assumption is he must have screwed up something.
Yes.
I mean, it just, and you can't blame him. It's just what happened. Well, Gordon Sullivan was just a wonderful, encouraging man, and, you know, and he was going to get me promoted if it killed him. Well, he couldn't. You just can't. I mean, this goes to an independent board. Chief of Staff of the Army has no more influence on it than the man in the moon.
Okay.
And he tried. He really tried. He would go to the war colleges, you know, the chiefs. All the chiefs go to all the other war colleges. And he had this slide that went up there. And this slide over here is Grant and Patton and Bradley and Marshall. And over here he has Colin Powell and Mark Hamilton.
Really?
Yeah. He said, okay, you know about those guys. You know a little bit about, this is kind of the old guys. Here's what the new thing is going to be. He said, you know about Colin Powell. Let me tell you about Mark Hamilton. And he talked about all the negotiating things. I mean, this is, he was a fan, okay? But it didn't work. So finally he had me assigned to a general officer billet with one of the assistant secretaries of defense, and who called me and said, what the heck happened here? Sullivan told me greatest guy, and you didn't even get promoted. And I said, well, didn't realize that, but thanks for the advice, and I'm sorry. So anyway, the chief calls. And I said, hey, don't worry about it. This been a great run, wonderful time, loved it. He said, tell you what I think I ought to do. And you fix me on it, Chief. This is October. In June, a job will open there as the Chief of Staff to the Alaskan Command, mm-hmm. commanded by a 3-star. Hey, terminal job, I understand that, but I'll be back in Alaska. And I've always wanted to be back in Alaska. Matter of fact, we actually owned a house here.
Yes.
In Alaska. Because it was home. We were coming back from the first assignment. I mean, this was going to be our place. So we had a house up in Eagle River. So I said, what I'll do is I'll write you the book on this, because now this sounds like ho-hum, but at the time, this wasn't a bad guess. I said, in the future, these are the kind of wars we're going to have to deal with. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to deal with the United Nations. We're going to have to deal with embassies. We're going to have to deal with non-governmental organizations.
Yes.
Okay? Nobody knows how to do this. And I think we need to write some doctrine on it. He said, that's just absolutely great. What's kind of ironic about that, in essence, I was asking for, and I called it this, a sabbatical.
Yes.
You know? Which,
and on that note, can I just take a sabbatical for a minute?
Sure.
Yes.
Thank you.